Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the January 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It would seem to be inconceivable that after more than 10 years of waging war in Afghanistan and Iraq, with nothing remotely resembling a victory to show from either battlefield, and our country trillions of dollars in debt, that Washington would be considering another potentially far more devastating war in the same region. But Washington, as we know it, is represented by more than the president and his cabinet. And while it may seem that the Obama administration is hesitant about launching a war against Iran, the next target in Israel's crosshairs, some of the both same powerful elements in our nation's capital that pushed us into the war on Iraq on Israel's behalf in 2003 are engaged in doing the same with Iran with equal, if not greater, fervor. With Congress, for all intents and purposes, safely in AIPAC's pocket, the pro-Israel web of think tanks, the Council for Foreign Relations, the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and the Saban Forum of the Brookings Institution, oh, did I mention the Foreign Policy Initiative, successor to PNAC? Well, and are debating whether the most stringent sanctions ever imposed on a non-belligerent country will be enough to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, or is it better to not only take out Tehran's nuclear facilities to amass a military strike, but its government as well? It's rare to find a talking head on any of the network news programs or on NPR that's not connected to one or more of these institutions. The fact that neither the CIA, the Mossad, nor any other intelligence agency has found any definitive evidence that Iran is actually in the process of producing such weapons or is capable of doing so now or in the near future is not considered by the experts within these think tanks to have any relevance. Nor has anyone of a similar stature who has questioned the right of the U.S. to attack a country that has not attacked us or anyone else, or threatened to do so unless in self-defense, been given the time on our national media to make the case against either sanctions or war. This morning we are going to talk again with someone who has made U.S. relations with Iran his field of expertise and who does challenge the conventional myopia of Washington's career warmongers. I'm speaking of Gareth Porter of the Interpress News Service, who will be making his fourth appearance on Takes on the World. We'll be speaking with Gareth at about 20 minutes past the hour, but first I want to bring you up to date on what's been happening in the past 2 weeks regarding Iran that makes a frank discussion of the subject so urgent. Since my last program, several important events have taken place that would seem to bring the chances of another war even closer. First was the murder of an Iranian nuclear scientist, 32-year-old chemical engineer Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, who died instantly when a magnetic bomb attached to his car by a passing motorcyclist exploded in traffic. Roshan was the fourth scientist connected with Iran's nuclear program to be assassinated in a terrorist attack in 2 years, all of which is widely believed had been carried out by Israel's Mossad, which has a decades-long history of murdering those perceived as enemies of the state, regardless of what country they happen to be in. It was no coincidence, some suspect, that the assassination took place just after Iran had announced it was ready to reopen talks about its nuclear program. Iran was quick to blame both Israel and the U.S., and the U.S. was almost as quick to deny any involvement. Both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and National Security Council spokesman Tommy Vitor immediately condemned the assassination and vehemently denied any U.S. involvement in that or any other violence inside Iran. It was the first time the U.S. government had chosen to distance itself so forcefully from actions that the mainstream media had generally treated as part of a joint U.S.-Israeli policy. The murder of Roshan was quickly followed 2 days later, another coincidence, by the apparent leak of a story that seemed intended to place a greater distance between the two countries and cast Israel in a negative light. It was the exposure of a series of CIA memos from the last 2 years of the Bush administration describing how Israeli Mossad agents posed as American spies to recruit members of the terrorist organization Jundallah to fight their covert war against Iran and carry out what are commonly referred to as false flag operations. According to investigative journalist Mark Perry, writing in Foreign Policy magazine online, The memos, as described by his sources, debunked reports from 2000 and 2008 that accused the CIA at the direction of the White House of covertly supporting Jundallah, a Pakistan-based Sunni extremist organization. But while the memos showed that the United States had barred even the most incidental contact with Jundallah, according to the two intelligence officers with whom Perry spoke, the same was not true of Mossad. The memos also detail CIA field reports saying that Israel's recruiting activities occurred under the nose of U.S. intelligence officers, most notably in London, the capital of one of Israel's ostensible allies. The officials did not know whether the Israeli program to recruit and use Jundallah is ongoing. Nevertheless, writes Perry, they were stunned by the brazenness of the Mossad's efforts. It's amazing what the Israelis thought they could get away with, the intelligence officers said. Their recruitment activities were nearly in the open. They apparently don't give a damn what we thought, end quote. The Israelis did get away with it, just as they did with the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967, which took the lives of 34 U.S. sailors and wounded another 171. Well, not only was there no report in the files of actions taken against Mossad, but aside from its circulation on the internet and the blogosphere, Perry's story was totally ignored by the mainstream U.S. media and NPR. Nevertheless, the assassination of the Iranian scientist and the leak to Perry of Mossad's double dealing may have contributed to the sudden and surprising cancellation of a much touted and long-awaited joint military exercise between the U.S. and Israel, which would have been the largest yet. That exercise, named Austere Challenge 12, scheduled for April, was intended to simulate a joint U.S.-Israeli effort to identify, track, and intercept incoming missiles by integrating sophisticated U.S. radar systems with the Israeli Arrow, Patriot, and Iron Dome anti-missile defense systems, all of which had been funded by U.S. taxpayers. What will happen to the first group of a projected 9,000 U.S. soldiers scheduled to participate in the exercise with the Israeli military, who reportedly began arriving in Israel in early January and were expected to stay there most of the year, was not mentioned. U.S. participation in the exercise, which would be geared to a scenario involving an Iranian retaliation against an Israeli attack on its nuclear facilities, would have clearly made the United States complicit with Israel in that attack. According to my guest Gareth Porter in an article that he wrote last week for Counterpunch with Jim Loeb, Obama and U.S. military leaders apparently decided that the U.S. couldn't take part in such an exercise so long as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to give the administration any assurance that it will not attack Iran without prior approval from Washington. The official explanation from both Israeli and U.S. officials about the delay was that both sides agreed to it. The Israeli papers Ma'ariv and Arutz Sheva, the Israeli National News Service, citing an article from London Times, reported that Israeli officials told visiting U.S. Joint Chief of Staff Martin Dempsey that it would give President Obama no more than 12 hours' notice if and when it attacks Iran. The Netanyahu government also, the report said, will not coordinate the attack with the U.S., the latest in a number of supposed scenarios concerning cooperation or lack of it between Jerusalem and Washington. There is speculation whether the rumors are based on facts or are leaked by officials to mask the possibility of secret military coordination. The London Times, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, a close friend of Netanyahu, said its sources explained that Israel fears that Obama would try to torpedo an Israeli attack if more notice were given because he is concerned that Iran will respond by blocking the Strait of Hormuz, sparking a rise in the price of oil that could cripple Western economies. If the attack were to occur in the next 10 months, the sources speculated, it would put President Obama in a tight spot on the eve of his bid for re-election. What has produced the latest development in the crisis has been the decision by the European Union to implement an oil embargo against Iran because of what German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle claims is, quote, Iran's refusal to fulfill its international obligations on the nuclear program, end quote. This comes on the heel of President Obama signing a draconian sanctions bill passed overwhelmingly, despite his objections, by both the Senate and the House, that going beyond the already in place oil embargo would prevent the U.S. government and any U.S. company doing business with any company or country that is dealing through Iran's central bank a piece of legislation that its authors and supporters proudly declared would bring Iran to its economic knees. Imagine, now changing reels, imagine if you would, that a Muslim American wrote an editorial in a Muslim American newspaper advocating the assassination of President Obama for the actions he has taken against Muslim nations. You would, of course, not hear the end of it. Not only would it make headlines in every American newspaper, but the story as well as the writer's arrest would be widely covered by every mainstream TV network, and the talking heads which are pushing us to attack Iran would be called upon to comment upon this latest affront to our democracy by the Islamic world. But what if the writer suggesting that President Obama might be assassinated was a Jewish American owner of a Jewish publication? I'll tell you the answer. Unless you lived in Britain, Canada, or Israel, or were a reader of the American Jewish press where the following story was reported, you wouldn't hear a word about it. Last week, Andrew Adler, owner, publisher, and editor of the weekly Atlanta Jewish Times, asked readers to imagine that they are Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, confronting the threat posed by Hezbollah and Iran's nuclear program, while also under pressure from a U.S. president with, quote, an Alice in Wonderland, end quote, belief in diplomacy over force. Adler laid out what he says are the three options available to Netanyahu: attack Hezbollah and Hamas, defy the U.S., which is willing to, quote, let Israel take a lethal bullet, end quote, by striking against Iran's nuclear facilities, or a third option. Quote, three, give the go-ahead for U.S.-based Mossad agents to take out a president deemed unfriendly to Israel in order for the current vice president to take his place and forcefully dictate that the United States policy includes its helping the Jewish state obliterate its enemies. End quote, Adler wrote in a column that appeared in print but not online. Yes, you read three correctly, he wrote. Order a hit on a president in order to preserve Israel's existence. Think about it. If I have thought of this Tom Clancy-type scenario, don't you think that this almost unfathomable idea has been discussed in Israel's most inner circles? End quote. Adler went on to ask, how far, quote, how far would you go to save a nation composed of 7 million lives, Jews, Christians, and Arabs alike? You have got to believe, like I do, that all options are on the table, end quote. Interviewed by Chris McGreal, Washington correspondent for London's Guardian, whose press is not so tightly controlled as ours, Adler said he understood why readers might interpret his writing as suggesting that Israel is seriously considering assassinating the U.S. president, but that is not what he meant. No, 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 it's unfathomable, unthinkable, he said, adding, I'm definitely pro-Israel to the max. Adler, who would later tearfully apologize in a TV interview, said he intended to repudiate the column in the next edition of the paper. I put my pen in my mouth, he said. I'm writing a retraction to the column. He may not get the chance, since the Jewish Federation of Atlanta announced it would break off its relations with the 86-year-old paper until a new managing editor was found. Adler has since appointed a new editor and has relinquished all day-to-day activities effective immediately and reportedly has put the paper up for sale. His column, as could be expected, was widely condemned within the Atlanta Jewish community and by a spokesperson for the leading national Jewish organizations. CNN's religious editor, writing online, reported that the Secret Service is investigating Adler over the column. That's the only mainstream media comment that I was able to find. Finally, the ongoing saga of what might be called the people of Ukiah versus Walmart, or Ukiah's version of the 99% versus the 1%, may come to a climax tonight when the city's planning commission meets to discuss and vote on a site development permit that Walmart requires before proceeding with the expansion of its current 109,000 square foot store in the Airport Boulevard Shopping Center by another 47,000 square feet into a 24/7 full service grocery store with the option of selling hard liquor. Last Wednesday, with a noticeable lack of enthusiasm, the city council, by a 4-1 vote, with Phil Baldwin being the lone dissenter, turned down an appeal of the first environmental impact report for the project that previously been passed by the Planning Commission, also by a 4-1 vote, and also with the same lack of enthusiasm. with both Mary Landis and Councilmember Mary Roden making it clear that turning down the appeal and acceptance of the final EIR should in no way indicate support for the project itself. The appeal had been filed by Attorney William Copper on behalf of the Citizens for Sustainable Commerce, as Steve Scalmanini, co-host of KZYX's Corporations and Democracy, Alan Nicholson, and myself. At the City Council meeting, Copper presented veteran traffic engineer Dan Smith, who with a PowerPoint presentation carefully took apart the proposed roundabouts that the EIR suggested would mitigate the greatly increased traffic tie-ups that the EIR acknowledged would be created should the Walmart expansion be approved, but for which no funding is available. In his defense, the project's own traffic engineer was forced to admit that what the EIR asked the city to approve was not in any way a projected design, but a quote-unquote cartoon. Yes, that's right. That's what the man said, a cartoon. Given that both Walmart and those developing the environmental impact report have been well aware for almost a year that finding a way to mitigate the impending traffic snafu was going to be the most important part of the EIR, one would think they would have come up with something other than a cartoon. Perhaps they did so because they concluded that there may be no solution to the dangerous and life-threatening traffic jams that the Walmart expansion would create. But the fact remains that what the Planning Commission voted to accept as adequate and that critical issue was nothing more or less than a cartoon. How had not traffic engineer Dan Smith challenged that aspect of the EIR, who would have known? If it was to approve the development site development permit, the Planning Commission, as required by the California Environmental Quality Act, would have to issue a statement of overriding considerations, which would declare that the benefits of Walmart opening yet another supermarket in a town awash with supermarkets exceeds the risk to the health and safety of the people of Ukiah and those who pass through the city on Highway 101. This is not to mention that the approval of the project would mean the likely closing of at least two of the currently existing supermarkets, as foreseen by the EIR, and the loss of scores of well-paying jobs with health benefits in exchange for a market that's known for paying the lowest wages and providing the poorest benefits in the food service industry.